My name is Pat Byrne, and no, I'm Pat Byrne and you're not. Hey, that's a cultural reference, 1980. I work at Corel. I'm in charge of the, nothing. Was part of the original Corel Draw team and part of the Netwinder design team. And the reason I'm here today is I learned a lot of this stuff porting ELF dynamic libraries to the StrongArm, ARM Linux. So I had to figure all this stuff out before I could do the port, and I've turned it into a talk, and here we are. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a summary of what we're going to cover in the next hour and a half. I apologize, but I got to spend 10 minutes on fundamental principles, okay? Let's suppose you want to build an app in multiple sections and stages. So you want to compile and assemble first, then you get all your segments, and then you want to run linking as a separate app. In order to do that, you create these intermediary files. And the intermediate files need to be reassembled at the end. In order to do that, we have to deposit little markers in the .o files to say how that they should be glued together to make an executable. These markers are called relocks. Oh, that's that's not what I planned to say, obviously. A relock consists of three parts. Where in the .o the fix-up should happen. I'm going to use the term relock and fix-up interchangeably. Where in the .o file the relock should be deposit its new information. A symbol that's associated with the relock. And an algorithm. Okay? An algorithm number. So we're talking about we'll see the algorithms in a few minutes. In addition to these three pieces of information that are stored in the relock, if we look at a .o file, you'll see code, data, and then an array of relocks. Each one of those relocks has the three pieces of information. And I just unplugged myself.
No, it's doing this.
Okay. No, it's traffic. Okay. There are three pieces of information stored explicitly in each relock. However, there is more information scattered around which the linker can use to gather together to actually do its work. There are size and type. The ELF object file format is stronger than the old ada.out format in that it does keep some information about type and size associated with each symbol. So the linker can look at the symbol name, look it up and get its size and type and get a little bit more information. And finally, if a relock says, go to this address and do something, in addition to the information that I've already spoken about, there is already a numeric value at that address. So we can use stuff that's already there. Like suppose there's a -4 there. We can use the fact that there's -4 there and involve it in the algorithm and get something more complicated. All right. So that's what a definition of a relock. Now, the first few times I gave this, I had to do a dry run of this talk, and I was talking to people at not the same skill level, so I spent 10 minutes going over static linking, pointing out that an app grows to, I don't know, what is it these days, 80K, if it's statically linked, actually. I can tell you. Statically linked with debugging is 460K, and stripped is 100K, whereas the dynamically linked version is only 25K. All right, and as you'll see in a few minutes, I have one that's 8K. So we go over static linking. I talk about all the steps that happen. This is a picture of the kind of things that would be in a .o file before it is linked, okay? Hello world simply makes one subroutine call to printf, and it invokes one string. The .o file has relocks for each one of those. Okay? So if you were to open up the .o file associated with hello world, you would see two symbols, and then the code with the symbol references. Let me show you what that would look like on screen. Object dunk minus sr. There we go. Okay, so this is a disassembly of hello world. Hello world has subroutine entry. It has a push of an address, which is the string for the hello world. And then it's got a subroutine call to a faraway library reference. Now, when the compiler builds this code, it doesn't know where these two things are going to be. So it drops relocks in here so that later on the linker can fill in the information and decide and build the complete app. If you are going to statically link these, the linker is going to look at the relock, including the symbol, the relock algorithm, and where it lies in the object file, and invoke the algorithm, repair the information, and drop it in. Similarly, for the second one, it's going to look at the symbol name, the algorithm, and the... symbol name, algorithm, and the address, and drop the information in here. So that's the linker's job, is to implement the algorithms. In statically linked case, these are going to be filled in with absolute numbers. Let's suppose that we decided now we want dynamic linking to happen. How are we going to implement it? Well, the ELF guys decided that relocks were good enough for that. Relocks are the transport mechanism, the markers that are used in the .o files in anticipation of a final link. The ELF guys decided that if relocks are good enough for that, they're good enough to leave markers in for dynamic linking. So in 1980, when did ELF become popular? 93, 94. In that time period, relocks ceased to become just a transport mechanism for intermediary files. They became ultimate transport mechanism for dynamically linked. Relocks now continue to persist even in your executables. And that's the important thing, is that the relocks, which are very, very similar, now continue to persist even in your executables. The only difference is the algorithms. All of the rest of the relock mechanism is the same. Symbols, where they are in memory, and size and type, all that stuff is still the same. The linker still runs the same mechanisms for looking things up. The only difference is there are a few more algorithms that are added to the list to implement dynamic linking. This slide just summarizes the responsibility of the linker. The linker, as we know it, can bind multiple .o files into an executable, either static or runtime, can bind multiple .o files into a shared library, and associated with the linker is this little tiny mini linker called ld.so, and his job is to do dynamic linking at runtime. It's a lightweight version of ld. Another part of the linker's responsibility is to gather sections of common attributes together. So if you've got 5.0 files and they each have code, data, RO data, and BSS, the linker's job is to gather all the codes together, all the data's together, all the RO data's together, and all the BSS's together so that like segments are gathered together. This ties into what I was talking about before the lecture started, where the code segments and the data segments are brought in together. They're mem-mapped in, so it's the linker's job to make sure that they're contiguous. This is a picture of Hello World as it exists on my machine, statically linked. There's 73 kilobytes of code, unbelievably. There are no relocks left in the executable after it is fully statically linked. It does not need any references to anything outside. It does not need ld.so in order to be able to run. which is a good thing sometimes. Now we bring in dynamic linking. We introduce the idea of relocks continuing to persist even into the executable. That allows your apps to be much smaller. Now let's try and build Hello World in dynamic linking. The first two stages of building Hello World are the same. You type in your hello.c in exactly the same way that you would have, and you run it through the first stage of the compiler and the assembler, and you get hello.o. And it's the exact same hello.o you would have used before. Only the third stage, in linking, instead of telling it to statically link, you tell it to dynamically link. And then the linker, instead of going to libc.a to get his helpers, he goes to libc.so to get his helpers. And he doesn't actually bring in the code. He brings in little stubs, which are helper stubs, and we'll go through all of that in a few minutes, resulting in the final result is a much smaller executable, which uses libc.so to implement what it's supposed to do. Now, let's drop to reality here for a minute. If I was to show you readelf is an alternative dumper which can open up any of these ELF files and show them to you in semi-English format. If I look at helloworld.o, this is a dump of the file header at the beginning. It's the dump of the map of the file saying where all the pieces are. The first segment here at the top, the first 20 lines, are the overall app descriptor, including the magic bytes at the beginning, explaining that this is an ELF file. It belongs on an x86 machine, how many segments there are, and that kind of stuff. Inside this header, there are two table of contents. There's a coarse table of contents and a fine table of contents. The fine table of contents is this one here, and it covers in fine detail all of the different sections that are on this machine. Code, data, read-only code, init code, constructors, destructors, comments, rel text. Actually, why don't I go through these? I should have brought my laser pointer. The text segment is where the code is. Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. Okay, this is much better. Sorry, monsieur. Est-ce qu'il y a des francophones ici? Okay. That's about all he'll get. The first section is the text section. That's the actual code. It's not very big. The second section is rel text. This is where the relocks for the code go. Okay, remember, the code is going to have some relocks. This is where they live. The next is the data section. So that's the non-zero data section. BSS is the zero data section. Notice it doesn't take any space on disk. Notes, I don't know what those are for. Stabs, rel stabs, stabs. RO data is const data. And these are symbol tables. So this fine-grained table of contents outlines what's in the file. In addition to the fine table of contents, where's the coarse one? It's not there. Okay. Apps have two tables of contents. They have a fine table of contents and a coarse table of contents. The coarse table of contents is used by the kernel to actually load the app and memmap the different segments. Sections are the tiny things. Segments are the collected large, massive pieces. Yes, sir? The notes section or comment? I don't know. It's tied in with debugger somehow. Next, we have the relocks. Now, the code, this Hello World, has two relocks. At this address, this algorithm, this symbol. At this address, this algorithm, this symbol. Don't worry about the second set of relocks. They're just for the symbol table and the debugger. And then finally, after all of that, is the symbol table. The symbol table has main and printf. The rest of these are involved in app starting and in link the linker maintenance. So the only important ones here are printf. It's the only symbol that's really important. If we were to look at the disassembly of helloworld.o, that's what we get. If we now go to the final app, okay, so that was a .o. The .o is tiny. It's like 300 bytes. Now I'm going to open up the 100 kilobyte static executable. And you see it's just huge. It goes on for days. And if I was to open up readelf, it's a very similar header. A few more sections, because as soon as you bring libc in, there's all kinds of sections involved, including destructors and constructors. Where are we? This section here is C++ and libc constructors, and these are destructors. And then there's lists of constructors and destructors that can be modified as the app is starting up and being taken down. So it's complicated, it's a mess, but that's it. This is the course table of contents associated with the same app. Notice there's only five pieces now. Two of them are marked loadable, and those are the only two that the app loader really cares about. Then we get into the symbol table. And the symbol table is huge because libc brings in all kinds of garbage with it. So what I did for the purpose of this class is I made my own library. I've got a little library called helloworldlib.c. And, no, that's the... My library is tiny, and it only has two entry points. It has a strlen, it has a puts, and it has an exit. And these are implemented in assembly language, so they don't have to call libc. Okay? So the idea is I want to build a hello world for you guys that isn't very complicated, that doesn't depend on libc. It only depends on this little guy. This guy only has two public symbols, the puts and the exit. Now, if we were to look at this guy, dump. This is the dump of the library. Let's go with the library. So, is that it? No, that's the beginning of it. It has strlen, which is a static, so we'll skip that. And it has a public puts here and an exit. And if you go through it, it has no relocks because he doesn't need anybody. So this guy exports symbols. He makes symbols available to other people, but he doesn't need any symbols. He has no dependencies. Okay? Exports only, no imports. Then we'll go look at Hello World written against this library. It basically has two subroutine calls. It calls puts with the string, and it calls exit. If we were to look at the intermediate file associated with that, I didn't save it. All right. Here's the executable associated with that app. The hello world string is still there. Where's the relux? There they are.
Yeah, with object dump, you, it keeps
dynamically. All right. Thank you. Thank you for that. I forgot about that. Nope, they're not in there. Anyway, the important thing is the resulting app does have relox in it to these two guys. So now we've got an app which has relox in it. And ld.so uses these relox to find the libraries to glue them together to make the thing run. Okay? So what I'm going to go through for the next hour is the mechanics of that. If you think about Hello World, we've got the code segment. In the code segment, he has to call printf. Where is printf? Well, it's somewhere else. It's in the library. In order to repair that and make the app operate properly, you've got blah, 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 jump to subroutine, printf. Now, the code, when it's running, is marked read-only. In the old days, it would be perfectly fine for someone to come along and especially for the app loader, to come along and despite the fact that the code is read-only, he could go in there and change it. He could drop the address of printf into that subroutine call and get the hell out, and the app wouldn't know, and the whole thing would execute. But in Linux, the code segment is memmapped. Okay? So we've got Hello World, we've got its code segment, it's been memmapped in, and it's been marked read-only. If the dynamic linker came along and dropped the address of printf into the subroutine, he'd be modifying the code segment. Now, that doesn't sound too disastrous. But in Linux, apps are memmapped, which means if you're running an app and I'm running an app and he's running an app, and if they're all memmapped, we're all actually sharing the same memory. You start up a 2-megabyte Netscape, you start a 2-megabyte Netscape, and you start a 2-megabyte Netscape, we're all sharing the same 2 megabytes. I can't have my dynamic loader coming along and dropping in the address of printf, and your dynamic loader dropping in a different address of printf. It just wouldn't work. So, in the a.out libraries, you guys all remember a.out, right? You're more older than 17. Actually, it's nice to see people my age out there. In the a.out world, printf was always at the same address. It was always at 40010123456. Always at the same address. The libc was given a load address. Libx was given a load address. Libelf, libjpeg, they were all given load addresses. But pretty soon we ran out of space. And libc was given a load address in 4 megabytes. Well, it got bigger. So it had to be given a new load address, and it got real messy. So one of the objectives of the ELF system was to make the dynamic libraries relocatable. So libraries go into your address space wherever they can, which means when you load libc, it might go in at 401. When I load it, it might go in at 402. So your idea of where printf is different than my idea of where printf is. And yet, we have to both be able to share the same copy of Netscape which calls printf. You with me? Okay, problem number one.
Isn't it only loaded once on the system?
Yes, but it appears in my memory map different than where it is in your... The question was, isn't printf and libc, by implication, isn't libc only loaded once in the system? Yes, it is loaded once in the system.
Once per version.
Once per version, thank you. Per version being the key part there. I love that joke. I'm going to write that one down. What did I do with that? Anybody sees that laser pointer?
I think you left it on.
It's a magic trick, I think. Okay. Where were we? Okay, we've done the magic. Done the magic in that class. That's enough. Juggling, right. Thank you.
Okay. And the comedy.
Yes, there is one copy of libc loaded, but it appears in your address map at a different place than it appears in my address map. Okay? Elf and the dynamic linker has to resolve all of that. So we have to get all of the relocks out of the code and put them somewhere else. Well, where else can they go? They have to go in the data. So we have to have a mechanism which takes the relocks out of the code and puts them in the data. Similarly, there's a whole bunch of data which you've got which is marked const. C++. You guys know that, right? Okay. All the const data actually lives in with the code. The idea is if you've got large amounts of const data, it makes sense that the linker should put it in with the code because it's read-only. That way your 25 kilobytes of const code that's in your Netscape is the same as mine and it travels with the code. So we have to move any relocks that are in the const data section out of the const data section and put them in the data section. Okay? So that's definition of problem number one. There's got to be a problem number two. I wouldn't have put number one there if there wasn't. Now, I've already mentioned this problem. The app always loads at a known address. Usually on x86, it's going to start, an app is going to load at 08048 something, something, something. On StrongArm and PowerPC, the load address is different. So your copy of Netscape and my copy of Netscape and his copy of Netscape all load at the same address. But the libraries are at different addresses. We have to come up with a mechanism that allows subroutine calls and data references to deal with a floating library. And the libraries have to be told that they themselves are floating. By floating, I mean the address is only resolved at runtime. So between problem number one and problem number two, we got the definition of the task involved in designing the dynamic linking system. In order to make all of this happen, the guys who designed ELF came up with the following idea. Normally what the linker does is he collects all of the code sections and glues them together and puts them in the executable. All of the data sections and glues them together and puts them in the executable. In the case of dynamic linking, the linker actually enlarges both the code section and the data section. Section or segment? Segment. With synthetic data, usually at the beginning. Now, the code segment gets this thing at the beginning of it called the procedure link table, PLT, which is synthetic. It's created by the linker. It's dropped in with the code, and these are jump stubs, which are used by the code in order to be able to get to partner libraries. Similarly, the data section is enlarged with this thing called a GOT, the global offset table. And it's in here where the linker scribbles all of the far addresses in order for the apps to be able to reach each other. Now, data is allowed to have relocks in it, so the data doesn't magnify itself. These two synthetic sections, the PLT and the GOT, are a result of having to take all the relocks out of the code segment. So there's a one-to-one relationship between, if there were 30 relocks that needed to be pulled out of the code, you'll probably find that there are 30 data structures here in the PLT and 30 data structures in the GOT. Now, remember, there could be some RO data in here, read-only data in here with the code. So if there's any repairs that need to be done in there, they are going to enlarge the GOT as well. So there are two forces at work which establish the size of the GOT, and the PLT is directly proportional to the number of jump stubs that need to be repaired. The number of jump stubs which are created in order to get rid of the relocks that were in the code. Yes?
All the calls to printf, though, will use the same jump stub.
Yes, that's right. the linker's smart enough to accumulate. Well, as a matter of fact, as far as this code's concerned, that's where printf is. Now, you and I know that printf is somewhere else. But as far as this code is concerned, that's where printf is. If this code takes the address of printf... Scott? No. This is actually something that's a current problem. If this code takes the address of printf, it's going to take this. Which means if somebody else, some other library that you're working with, takes the address of printf, they're going to end up with a different address and you're toast. But that's the way the world is. Is everybody clear on what just happened? Okay? The linker has to create synthetic sections in order to be able to make this thing work. Okay? What I'm going to do now is spend just a few minutes of take the tempo down a little bit more relaxed. I'm going to go through some of the relocks that are involved in putting all of this stuff together. Now, when I say relocks, what I really mean is the algorithm associated with a relock. A relock has three pieces of explicit information: the symbol, where the relock should be, and the algorithm. And I'm just going to talk about the algorithms. There are four zones in which we can talk about these algorithms showing up. Relocks which exist in object files which are destined to be part of an executable, object files which are destined to be part of a library, the ultimate executable, which has buried relocks in it because it's dynamically linked, and then the shared libraries themselves, they have relocks in them as well. So there's four zones. Sorry, you had a question?
When you said that the code space is modified, I think some extra memory for the relocks.
Mm-hmm.
That you already told us earlier that if you're in a demo, every bit of memory has to have an associated file.
That's in the exe. Oops. That's in the executable file image.
Okay, so that's actually that's the
linker does it at link time.
Right.
So it's saved. It's in. If you open up your I gotta get somebody to react to .exe. Yeah, right. Throw money. Okay, let me just go through some of the relocks so you get an idea of what kind of algorithms we're talking about. There's a relock. Oh, again, all of this stuff is x86 oriented just because of the population. This lecture was originally designed to explain the ARM relocks. Just change those three letters to ARM. PowerPC has a different set of algorithms. Spark has a different set of algorithms. So these are specifically the x86 algorithms. This means it's a relative relock. What this algorithm says is that the linker, whoever's repairing this relock, should find the symbol, find out how far it is from here to the symbol, and add that to whatever's currently at the relock address and drop it in there. It's the definition of the algorithm, okay? If you want to see that, let me show you that, how that algorithm is resolved. In home parent projects, libc, glibc, elf, nope, systems, there's a file in your glibc source code called dlmachine, and it's machine-specific. And in there, we've got some code which shows how these relocks are resolved. For instance, when linker, when actually this is ld.so, when ld.so has to deal with one of these relocks, what he does is he takes the distance from wherever we are to the symbol and adds it to what's currently at the relock and drops it in there. One line. It says that says the algorithm better than I could have. Let's cover another one. This one is an absolute relock. What this algorithm says is use the symbol, find out where that entity exists, take its address and drop it in. Okay, that's a direct drop-in of an absolute address. It ignores what's already there, just drops the address right in. Those two algorithms are the only algorithms which exist in a .o file, which is going the old-style .o files. Okay, if you're building an executable, that all your .o's are going to be filled with those two algorithms, either an absolute drop-in or a relative. If you've got a .o file, which is going to be in a shared library, anything which is going to be dropped into a shared library has to deal with the fact that he doesn't know where he's going to be at execution time. He could be low, he could be high, he could be in the middle. The compiler needs to know this, because the compiler has to deal with the uncertainties of addresses. So the compiler needs to be informed. The compiler then creates some new relock types, which didn't exist before, to deal with this uncertainty of where it's going to be loaded. These relock types are passed to the assembler, and the assembler turns them into the binary equivalent, and bingo, we've got relocks in your .o file. And the kind of algorithms that we're talking about are got offset, got32, got PC. These are three algorithms which deal with data, finding the address of something, data blocks, where the data is, pointers to things, all that kind of stuff. How are we doing on time? 5 to 4, 3:15. Oh, we're fine. PLTs are the relative ones. These are used for jumps. So these three are used for data, and the last one is used for jumps. GotPC is an interesting one. If you've got a subroutine in a library, and of course they're all subroutines, right? Because you call into a library. On the way into the subroutine, the first thing the subroutine does is establish where he is in memory. Okay, so there's a he evaluates a pointer to self in order for him to get his bearings on where he is in memory. Now that code, does anybody? Yeah, let's have a look at that code. I've got an SO here somewhere. Don't do that. There we go. Here's a subroutine. This is a .o file, which is not yet an executable. Okay, it's not yet a library. On the way into the subroutine, he pushes a bunch of stuff, and then he calls address 25. So he calls himself. Now, when you do a subroutine call in the x86, pushes your current address onto the stack. Or actually, it pushes address of next onto the stack. So then he pops it off. So this sequence, this 6-byte sequence, pops off the address of self into EBX. So now he knows where he is. All public entry points into shared libraries have this preamble. Okay? Call self, pop the stuff off the stack. Now I know where I am. Knowing where you are is okay, but by convention, what happens immediately following is there's an add, and he adds in the offset to the got. Remember I showed you the got? Every public subroutine creates for himself a pointer to got and leaves it in EBX. So for the balance of the subroutine, EBX points to the address of the got, which is fairly early in the data segment. So now he has a pointer to his data segment. Once he's got a pointer to his data segment, he's away to the races. He can find everything. He can find his own data. He can find his own subroutines. Okay? So this is a bit of overhead that exists on every public subroutine in a shared library. Private subroutines inside the shared library don't matter because they know that when somebody calls them, it must be one of his brethren in the same library, so EBX is already set up.
This is a .o?
This is a .o, which is intended to go into a shared library.
So the tools have to know that it's going to be in a shared library. compiler.
Right. In order to do this, we have to trigger the compiler. We have to tell the compiler he needs to create this extra special, this extra overhead code, because this .o will end up eventually in a library and must be relocatable. So you put a minus f pick on the command line. The compiler will generate extra code and synthesize these relocks and drop them in. Now, this particular reloc is part of the preamble, and you'll see it several times because I have several subroutines.
You should mention that pick is position-independent code.
Yes, thank you. F pick. Well, it's in a later slide. This particular reloc shows up once per public subroutine, and is synthesized by the compiler. When the linker gets hold of this, he can actually resolve this at link time. So this particular reloc does not persist through into the shared library. This one gets resolved and disappears. If there were other relocs in here of these other types, you'd see that they continue to exist. Let's go back a page. Got offsets and got PCs are fully resolved by the linker. They can be figured out while the shared library is being built. However, got 32s continue to exist even in the shared library, and they need to be fixed up when the app is launched at runtime. PLT 32s usually persist into the shared library. The only time these disappear is when the linker knows for sure he can find an address, and that means if you're jumping to another subroutine within your same library, then the linker can resolve a PLT32, throw it away, and it will disappear from the library. But most of the time, PLT32s continue to exist in the ultimate library. That being said, the algorithm for the PLT32 is just the same as the algorithm for the subroutine call on the previous page. It just takes the relative distance to the subroutine and drops it in. I'm going to skip over the next because we have to get to the interesting stuff. These are the relocs which can exist in executables. You can have 386 copies, glob data, and jump slots. And these are the relocs which can exist in shared libraries. Now we'll get to the interesting stuff. What's in the PLT? Okay, the PLT is glued onto the beginning of your code. It is an array of jump stubs which are used by the shared library to get out of the library to where the stuff is supposed to be. PLTs also exist in your app. So there's a PLT glued on the beginning of your app, which is a bunch of jump stubs which help you get to your libraries. So if you call printf, there'll be an entry in the PLT. And when you want to call printf, you'll jump to the PLT, and the PLT will go to the library, wherever the library is, up at 4 billion. Okay? Now, if you have n subroutines that you're about to call, printf, puts, draw rectangle, whatever, there will be n plus 1 entries in the PLT. There's one more for overhead. Each entry in the PLT is 16 bytes. If we were to look at it in RAM, it's going to look something like this. No, wrong one. No. There's a PLT. That's the PLT that's glued on the top of my Hello World. And you can see these are addresses. So they're strips of 16 bytes each. And they're very symmetrical. And if you were to disassemble this, it would be that. Each entry in the PLT is a jump, indirect jump. And it's indirect because you want this stuff to be non-malleable? You want this stuff to be read-only. So the jump goes through the got. And the God is elsewhere, and it's in the data segment, and it is malleable. It's writable. So the linker makes the changes in the got, and when you need to call printf, it comes through here, bounces off here, and goes to the library. There's the library up there. All right? Yes?
I guess I've missed the reason why it doesn't simply refer to got in the first place. Why the extra step of the PLT if we don't?
Because
it does. The first time you call it, it's not right.
Right. That's the next. That's where we're headed next. Sorry?
I was going to say the PLT has to be created in the first time.
No, but he's right. If why couldn't this indirect jump just be in the code? Well, one reason is an indirect jump is physically a different number of bytes in Intel assembly language. So that's one problem. But that's only a distraction. The real answer is this works in cooperation with the got. Okay? Wouldn't it be nice if we've got a big app, okay? It's 2 megabytes, and it's got thousands of these indirect jumps. Wouldn't it be nice if we only repaired the ones that we need to? So the ELF guys came up with this idea of deferred resolution of the fix-ups. When you first start up an app, your got will, in fact, be empty. Actually, it isn't empty. It's got a bunch of pointers which point back to here. Okay? See where the laser pointer is? So when you start up an app, you've got all your thousands of entries in the PLT. Each one of those entries in the PLT points into the got, and the got points back to here. So when an app is started, he has not actually done all of the fix-ups for all the different symbols. If you're calling thousands of subroutine entries in hundreds of DLLs, sorry, shared libraries. All of the symbol lookups are not done at app load time.
No need to resolve all the symbols and all the zillions of libraries to handle dash dash versioning.
Versioning is one problem, and the other problem is just the bulk of looking all these things up. Now, if you look at what actually has to happen in real life, it turns out your data has to be all fixed up. So if you think of what the dynamic linker has to do when he's starting an app, he has to fix up all the data references and the code references. Well, he goes ahead and does all the data fix-ups. But the code fix-ups are deferred. They are not resolved until the first time you call the subroutine. Now, let's continue to use printf as an example. Your app calls printf. Printf jumps to here. That goes into the got and gets the address. The address effectively means I'm not yet resolved, and it bounces back to here, to this push. Okay? So the push pushes an integer onto the stack and jumps to the first PLT entry, which takes us to the resolver. It's called resolver, but what it is it's the guy which can look up a symbol at runtime and do the repair at runtime. So your data is all fixed up as your app is launched, but your subroutines are only fixed up when they're needed. Now, as soon as you jump off to the resolver is going to go into the got and repair the address in the got. Okay, this is elsewhere. I'll deal with the got in a few minutes. So the got now has the repaired version of where printf is. So the next person that comes along to call printf will simply bounce off of this and go directly to printf. Okay? So that's what this overhead. Now, that happens to add up to 16 bytes. There is one special entry in the got, which is the first one. And he's the guy that helps us jump indirectly to the resolver. Now, the resolver is in ld.so. Some of you may know it as ld-linux.so.2. Okay? He's the guy that loads your apps for you. He's the runtime linker. The first entry in the PLT just looks like this. It pushes one more piece of information onto the stack and jumps off to the resolver. Now, this is always located in ld.so, and it bounces off the got. So the got is an array of entries, and got sub 2 is the address of the resolver. So when the dynamic linker is loading all the libraries, he always drops in to each one of the libraries the address of the resolver. Now, don't forget this PLT. There's going to be a PLT for the app and one for each library. Now, the GOT has three sections. The first three elements of the GOT are special. The next, we'll deal with those. GOT 0, okay. If you think about what ld.so has to do, ld.so has to open up, 6 or 8 or 10 libraries and the app. He has to find the symbol tables for those 6 libraries and the app. He has to be able to walk the symbol tables to find, to resolve where something should be, and he has to have enough code to implement the algorithms, do the fix-ups, and let the app run. In order to do that, he has to maintain a data structure for each library that he loads. Okay, he loads the app, he loads printf, he loads the app, he loads libc, and he loads libm and libx. Okay, so let's suppose he's got 4 libraries loaded. He needs 4 data structures. And what's the best way to keep them organized? Put them in a linked list. So he actually uses GOT0 as a pointer to next. We're not supposed to know this, but that's what GOT0 is destined for. And ld.so uses that as a pointer to next. GOT1, it turns out that most of what ld.so needs to manage a library is in the memmapped version of the library. But it turns out as time passed, ld.so needed some extra data to manage each library. So GOT1 points to private data associated with this lib. It's used by ld.so, and that's the private dev structure. GOT2 is always gets the address of the resolver so that the PLTs can jump through here to resolve symbol lookups. All right? The next section of the GOT contains n entries, one for each PLT entry. So if you had 1,000 PLT entries, there's going to be 1,000 entries in this area. And they work in cooperation. Each PLT is a jump stub that jumps through one of these entries to the ultimate target. Okay? When the app is loaded, these all contain pointers to the resolver. Actually, they have pointers back into the PLT, and it bounces off the second half of the PLT back into the resolver. It turns out the linker is smart enough to prepare all of this stuff. So when you actually look at your app as it's stored as a file image on disk, you'll see that this stuff is all pre-prepared with all of the initialized data structures to point to the initialized data to point to the right place. The final section of the GOT is global object references. These are indirect pointers that are used by the compiler to deal with the fact that it's built position-independent code. You write a bunch of C code, you compile it with the fpic flag, which is asking the compiler to produce position-independent code, because it's going to go into a library. In order to do that, there are many times where you thought you were pointing at something. Well, you can't do that anymore, because you don't know where you are. So the compiler, on your behalf, generates a pointer to a pointer, and puts a relock in the middle, so that at runtime, the pointer to the pointer can be fixed up. And even though your C code looks like it's pointing at something, if you look at the assembly language, you'll see it's indirected one time, bounces off the GOT, and points to whatever it should be. And if you look at your relock table, you'll find that all of these guys are going to have relocks pointing at them. Because at runtime, all this area needs to be tickled all over the place with all different kinds of algorithms, depending on what the compiler was trying to do. The guy that actually loads your code is ld.so. When you run an app that's dynamically linked, the kernel will find your app, memmap it in, and then he finds this guy and memmaps him in. So ld.so is mapped in, and he's the guy who executes first. Your app does not execute first. ld.so executes first. Okay? He looks at your app, and opens up one of the segments that I told you about before called dynamic. And in there is a list of all of the libraries that he needs. Then ld.so goes and finds those libraries and memmaps them in and looks at their dependencies. And it just, is that recursion? Anyway, it just goes down and down looking at all the dependencies until all the dependencies are completely resolved. Then he runs the init code on each library. Then he lets your app run. And of course, your app never starts with your own code. It always starts with your implicit init and then in implicit constructors and all your static constructors and all that stuff happens before you ever get to your own main. Every dynamic app, or it's, what time are we at? Quarter after 3:15. Oh, I got 15 minutes. Perfect. How's energy doing? Okay, all right. Okay, let me just cover this dynamic thing and then we'll... This is my hello world again. This is the header. This is the find table of contents. And this is the course table of contents. If we go back and look at the at the course table of contents, one of the things in here is dynamic. And if we look at the find table of contents, you'll find that there's a dynamic section as well. Here. So both table of contents have a pointer to this dynamic section. This is what the dynamic section contains in this app. The dynamic section contains everything that ld.so needs in order to be able to start up. So that would be things like the fact that it needs this library. The init code for self, where my own symbol table is, where my own PLT got is, where my PLT relocks are, and what version, there's some versioning stuff in here saying I need certain versions of libraries and things. And actually, this isn't used by executables. This is used more by the libraries. Yeah. So this array of information is only used by ld.so in order to be able to find things. This is a simple app. He only has one library dependency. If we open up, well, we could try and open up Netscape. Anybody know where it is on my machine? Pretty good. Where's his dynamic section? There we go. This is his dynamic section. So there's several. These are the libraries that he needs. And his start, where his startup code is and where his PLT and GOT are. His... Why did I emasculate that? I don't know. So that's what's in the dynamic section, and that's what ld.so looks at. So far we've explained, if we look at that course table of contents, yeah, we'll do that. Here's the course table of contents for Netscape. This is his code. And it gets memmapped in and marked as read-only and executable. This is his data, and it's brought in and marked as read-write. And as far as the kernel's concerned, he only looks at these two, code and data. This one is used by ld.so to find all of the dynamic information to do the runtime linking. This is used by the kernel to find the app that's used to actually do ld.so. When I say ld.so is the loader, that's a generic name. But at any point in time, when you build an app, it's actually going to get a substituted the real name. And this app needs this interpreter to load. And then pheader is just where all the overhead is for all of this table of contents and stuff. So it's really this points to self. So that explains the five pieces involved in the course table of contents. Now, if we were to look at the find table of contents, it's full of all kinds of junk that has to do with debugging and single-stepping and profiling and version control and all that kind of stuff. So we're not going to do that. We. Okay, is everybody comfortable with what's happened so far? I'm getting some nods. Okay, what I want to do is cover a weird case just to show you the kind of complexities that come into this. Let's suppose we have a library which creates a static global variable, something like Erno. Okay? It's global. Everyone has to be able to see it. Everyone has to be able to take the address of it. And let's say it's initialized. Now, Erno is not a good example, because if any of you know libc these days, Erno is in fact a subroutine. But let's go back. Take the time machine back 5 years. Erno was an int. It's declared, defined, and as far as the authors are concerned, it exists in libc. But all the app needs to be able to find it, libc needs to be able to find it, and the other libraries need to be able to find it. And I don't know why this is, but somebody decided that it should cease to exist in libc, and it should be moved down into the app's data space. Does anybody know why that is? Could have something to do with threading, I don't know. Probably nothing to do with caching. Anyway, given this is what happens. Any global initialized data which is initialized in a library at runtime gets taken out of the library and put into the app's data space. Down in the app, down at 0804, down there. In order to do that, there's a whole bunch of relocks that are created that cooperate with each other to make this happen. There's a reloc called 386 copy. This reloc exists in the executable. And this says where the data should go in the executable. So in the case of Erno, my hello world would have one of these relocs saying this is where Erno should exist when the app is running. Then up in the library, there's a corresponding reloc called glob data, which points at the original Erno before it's moved. And any references to Erno in the library have this reloc on them so that they're going to bounce down to the new one, which is down in the EXE. Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you. That's right. Not the EXE, the executable file image. Could you ask the question again, please?
If Erno stayed in the library, wouldn't it share it?
If Erno continued to exist in the library, wouldn't it be visible to everyone and shareable? Yes, I think so. I don't understand the reason behind this mechanics, but what I want to do is just describe to you what happens in real life. I can't justify it. I wasn't able to find the reason, but there must be one. If you don't move it to the program space, yes, I don't know why this happens, but it does happen.
Won't it share the same value?
Won't it share the same value? No, because Erno can be modified. No, it's in it. The question was, would it be changed between processes? No, Erno or whatever it is we're talking about always exists in the data segment of the library, and the data segments are marked as writable. So you get distinct versions in the different processes. Let me show you what happens in real life. Let's suppose we've got an app. And in the app, there's some code. And the code references my symbol called Erno. Okay? My symbol table is going to say that Erno is... down here in my BSS segment. Now, BSS starts off as being all zeros. Now, the library has a reloc in it and a symbol table. The reloc says that anybody who needs to refer to Erno should get this reloc applied to it. And in the code, any references bounce off a got entry and end up over here. So if the library ever needs to point to Erno, it bounces off a got and ends up being here. In the read-only data section of the library is the initialization data. Now there's going to be, see this copy and this glob data. When this relock algorithm is executed, what it does is it reaches up into the library initialization and copies it down to BSS. So this algorithm precipitates a mem move from the const area of the library down into the data section of the executable. The execution of this algorithm runs through and puts the resulting address in the got, and it modifies the symbol table. So before this was executed, the symbol table here used to point to here. The symbol table in the library used to point into the read-only section of the library to explain where the const data was. After the mem move is done, the symbol table is modified so that the symbol now points to here. So later on, if anybody needs that symbol, like does a dynamic lookup or whatever, they're actually going to point down into the app. So the symbol table is in fact modified. Weird. So this is an exception. It's a weird ball thing. I don't know why it happens, but if you're looking at the code and you see these relocks, that's what they're doing. Let's go over some mechanics. If you want to make a shared library, you must compile the code with minus fpic, position independent code. That informs the compiler that it has to do a bunch of dirty stuff, especially with respect to pointers to far objects. Pointers to far objects quite often end up as pointers to pointers. And relocks are created to deal with that fix-up, that intermediary fix-up. Plus, any public subroutines get a preamble on them, so they get a pointer to self. Further, all of the assembly code assumes that EBX is a pointer to the got associated with this library. So that's what fpic does. It precipitates a whole bunch of stuff, and the assembly language that spews out is very different. Okay, it's fully prepared to deal with position-independent code. Yes, sir?
Lowercase and uppercase pic?
No, as far as I know, there's no difference between lowercase and uppercase pic. Did everyone hear that? On one of the Spark compilers, there was a distinction between uppercase and lowercase pic. But certainly on x86 and StrongArm, there is no difference between them.
Well, no, let's put it the other way.
And there apparently still is a difference in Spark. So if you're doing Spark code, be careful. Otherwise, be sloppy. Okay. I'm sorry?
GCC, as far as I know, doesn't differentiate. Compiler does.
Spark, yeah. And I believe there is a machine around somewhere which doesn't need fpic, but AIX. You can just go ahead and compile code, and it'll be library ready. Excellent. Give me one. Give me one. Anyway, having built, okay, the minus C here is going to cause this to spew out a .o. Having built all of your .o's, you can go ahead and link them as you would normally. Combine all your .o's, and it will produce... With the minus shared flag, that will produce a .so. So there are two pieces of things that you have to do differently here. Let me try the vibe. There we go. You have to put fpic on your compile line, and you have to put shared on your link line. The resulting thing that spews out of here is a library. It still has relocks in it, but that's okay. They should only be relocks which are capable of being resolved at runtime. To make an app, you don't have to do anything different in the first stage. Just go ahead and compile. In the second stage, you can link in with .so's. And GCC is smart enough to say, well, that's a .so. I'm not going to bring in the whole thing. I'll just bring in the symbol. And, of course, he adds this. If he sucks anything out of this, he adds this to the dependency list.
If he doesn't,
yes. You can go ahead and pepper your command line with .so's. And if they're not used, they won't be linked.
Are there any implementations to
No, you can go ahead and build apps with fpic. And you can build many, many .o's with fpic and some without. You can combine them all together. It will work. Position-independent code is a superset of...
It's a little bit less efficient due to the finding out where here is. And
there's a prologue in each subroutine, and pointers to data often end up as pointers to pointers to data. But it will execute. However, you cannot do the opposite. Before we leave the subject, everything I've talked about today was finding objects and linking them implicitly. You write your code as if, like, for instance, you write your code, you call printf. It's the linker's job and the runtime linker's job to find printf and give you your code. You can also dynamically link explicitly. Go ahead and build an app, and then, which depends, suppose you build an app which depends on libc only. You can explicitly bring in other libraries. Suck the symbols out of them, find out where they are, and execute them. You could, for instance, this case, the lower case here. I've got an app. It calls dlopen, and it goes and finds libm and brings it in. Having done that, now all of the symbols in libm are now available to me. I can make a subsequent subroutine call, dlsymbol, and I can look for the symbol cos. Okay, so it's an ASCII string. It goes through the symbol table, does a symbol search, returns a pointer. Where is it? Cosine, there. That's the name of the pointer, cosine. Now that I have this pointer, I can use it to call a subroutine. If anybody's familiar with Microsoft, it's the same as load library, get proc address, and free library. The difference is, in Microsoft world, you can only load subroutines. You can only find subroutines in DLLs. In this world, you can find anything that has a symbol. That's subroutines and data. Now, not everything has symbols. There's quite a few times when there will be an anonymous piece of data which doesn't have a symbol. But if you look carefully at the relock, you'll find that the relock will be with respect to the beginning of something, with respect to the beginning of the data segment, with respect to the beginning of the RO data segment, with respect to the beginning of the text segment, and so on. Okay, so even though objects, symbols appear to disappear, even though symbols are missing from your symbol table, if you look closely, you'll find that it's an offset from the beginning of your const data section. Okay. One of the handiest uses of that dynamic linking thing, let me go back a page. Let's suppose you want to do multi-language translations. Okay? Build a shared library which has all of the English phrases with symbol names or numbers. Build another shared library with all the French ones and another shared library with all the Spanish ones. And then at runtime, link in the translation library. Look up the symbol, and it can be the same symbol name in different libraries. Get the string and use the string, and off you go. Jim, why are you here? You know all this stuff. There's a couple of people sitting in here that helped me do the port to ARM Linux, and they should be telling me what's going on. There's some fun apps which you can use if you want to examine what's in either shared libraries, .os, or .so's. Object Dump has some, it took me 2 years to find some of the really neat ones. Minus SR will give you a disassembly with the source code merged in and the relocks. So for the purposes of teaching, that's my favorite, capital SR. Lowercase s gives you a hex dump, so you can see where all the stuff is, how big stuff is, what the PLT looks like and what the GOT looks like before it gets munged up by the linker. There's another one called readelf, which comes as part of binutils, and minus a will show you everything that's in the header. And as I said, it applies to the four cases. .os, which are intended for apps, intermediary files intended for apps, intermediary files which are intended for libraries, the apps themselves, and the libraries themselves. NM is kind of old now. All it does is show you your symbol table. You can get your symbol table out of either object dump or readelf. LD.so is the dynamic linker, and it's called by the kernel to actually do your dynamic linking. You can call it, all right, which is kind of neat. You can run it as an app. So let's try my hello. Here's my hello world running. If we were to follow, watch this, S-trace. S-trace or L-trace? Well, let's do an S-trace. Well, let's do an S-trace. Okay. Here's what happened between LD.so and the kernel as the app is starting up. Do you guys mind going a little bit over time?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now remember, when the app starts, the guy that's actually running is LD.so. So the first thing that he does is loads my app, my Hello World, to run.
That's the shell
that did this? Yes. Okay, sorry, that's not that guy. Okay, so where the laser pointer is where LD.so is running. The first thing he does is call break zero, which is... remember when I had this picture? I don't know how many of you guys were in here before. When an app is loaded, the kernel maps the code into the app's memory space. He maps the data into the data's memory space. And then he enlarges the data memory space to make space for BSS. Okay, so that's the initialized data and the zeroed data. When you start calling malloc, these malloc calls do not go directly to the kernel. They go to libc. Because you don't want the kernel dealing with hundreds of thousands of little mallocs. All the mallocs go to libc. Libc then turns around and occasionally, it saves them all up, and it occasionally asks the kernel for more memory. So the kernel keeps one scalar value, this point, it's called the break marker. Keeps a scalar value, one single pointer, of how much memory he's allocated so far. If you want more memory, what you can do is ask the kernel to move the break marker. And that you just call sys s break, or is it break or s break? Anyway, you make a kernel call s break, and the kernel will move the break marker down and give you another 16k or 64k of memory. He gives it to glibc, and glibc will give you back your malloc. So the kernel has one pointer which keeps track of how much memory he's given out so far. So the first thing ld.so does is find out, at break zero, is find out where's the break pointer is. And a little bit later, he doesn't make any subsequent calls, but after you do a few mallocs, you'll see a call to sysbreak to move the break marker down. See these opens? That's ld.so. First thing he does is open etc ld.so.preload to find out if there are any libraries which should be preloaded. Now, for most of us, we don't have that file, so we get back a minus one. Then he opens up ld.so.cache, which is his own private binary cache of where the libraries are on the hard drive. And then he memmaps it, because memmap is faster than reading. After he's memmapped, he can close it, and it's still mapped in. At this point in here, he is looking at my hello world and looking at the dependency list. He sees that my hello world needs libc. He runs very quickly through his ld.so.cache and he finds out where libc is and he opens it. Stats it to find out how big it is. Reads the header. Now, ld.so is a shared library. In order to manage it, he has to read the header because the header's got the map of where the table of contents, all that stuff. So he reads the map with a read. He reads 4k in. In there is a table of contents. Based on the table of contents, he calls memmap and memmap to map the code and the data. Now notice the protections here. Read-only executable. That's the code being mapped in. And then read-write. That's the data being mapped in. Now, libc also needs a BSS. He's got a code, he's got data, and he's got BSS. So the third mem map is a BSS. So you can even see how much code and data is in libc.
Okay, and the map anonymous says
that
the file is this one.
The source of this data is not the file, but it's, well, the original source is dev null, but then the binding should be to the swap.
Dev zero.
Thank you. Yes, dev zero. So the source of the data for this is dev zero, but after it's brought in and dirtied, it's then bound to the swap file. All of this stuff will also, when the data is read, it's being read from the original file. As soon as it's dirty, it's bound to the swap file. And the code, of course, is marked read-only, so no one can dirty it, so it's always associated with libc. The nice thing about this whole memory management scheme is in Linux, all the app data is always discardable. It's either associated with the original disk, the original file, dev0, or the swap file. So it's all completely expendable. On the other hand, all of the kernel data is never swapped out. So apps are always swappable. Kernel is never swappable. It's black and white. Now, if any of you guys come from the Windows world, you know you have to have page-locked memory. And the kernel has page-locked and unlocked and swappable and discardable. And everybody has to always be aware of paging and locking. In Linux, if you're an app, you're discardable. So we got the libc being brought in. Now, libc is closed. And who's unmapped here? That's
LD.
No, that's the cache, probably. Yeah, that's the cache that's unmapped. Personality is set. The PID is set. And who's this? That's giving me some more memory, I guess. And then he runs my hello world, unmaps somebody, and exits.
Unmaps or unmap?
Yeah, I don't know where that's coming from. So this, all this over, that's all this stuff that I'm.
That's a STDI runtime script of the printer. It's a STDI, it's a buffer for
printer. We can work this through, but let me just gloss over it and we can come back to it. All of this stuff that I'm scribbling on here, all of this is activity that's done by ld.so. And this is my app. Okay. I didn't show you what I wanted to show you, which was, right. Okay. Here's my hello world. Here is libldlinux.so.2 on my hello world. It just runs. However, I can put some flags in here like list, and instead of running the app, it goes through all of the steps of dynamic linking, finding the libraries, mem mapping them, calculating the offsets, and it gives me a summary of where everything would have been.
Is this the same thing as LDD?
That LDD is, in fact, a shell script which does this. And it prints out a summary of where the libraries would have gone if they had been loaded. Now, you can ask for more stuff here and get lots more information. This is the old-style way of doing it. There is a new style way of doing the same thing where you simply run your application with some environment variables. LDDebug files will do the same kind of thing. The difference is when you invoke ld.so explicitly with the minus list options, it doesn't actually execute the app, it only pretends to. Doing it this way with the environment variable, it does execute the app. It just gives you more debugging about what it's doing. It found libc.so. Here's where the link maps are. And you can see the start code for libc.so being called and the close code being called. There's lots of different options you can do with that debug flag. For instance, I can show you the relux. Nope.
Where did, it should have fixed up my printf. Oh, maybe that's under symbols. Yeah. And, of course, there's all kinds of overhead involved in starting up libc and standard I.O. Unfortunately, that's a bit of a distraction. If we look at... that's not right. Okay. And what's another one, Scott, besides... Relox symbols, files, and... All? Oh, my goodness. Okay, here's an interesting one. Here's... I don't know why he bothered looking... Oh, this is... right. I asked for it to execute my own thing here. And here's the search path, looking for the library. Now, it couldn't find the library because the actual library is not on the search path. So I'll do that this way. LD library path equals here. There we go. So here's where it searched for the library. Now, this library is not a part of the cached system, not part of ld.so.cache, so he had to search for it. Here's all the places where he searched for it. Then he found it, fixed up the relox in it, bound the symbols. There's the symbol that it fixed up. Executed my app, and continued on and finished. Lazy is the business. Remember when we were talking about the PLTs? That the PLT fix-ups are not done until the first time. That's lazy. You can coerce ld.so into fixing up all the subroutine calls. So it will do all... It always does the data, but you can also force it to do all the subroutines as well.
So you get it interrupted later?
Yes. The advantage of ld.lazy is that the app starts a little quicker, plus subroutines can be overloaded. No, forget that. You can always overload a subroutine address. If you're interested in finding all of this stuff, it's in it's on the previous page. And we're almost done. Only one more slide. If you want to see the source for all this stuff, it's in your glibc source. The source for ld.so is in a file called rtld.c, realtimeloader.c. And the objects that it plays with are defined in include elf.h. And there's another file, if anybody's writing this down, sysdeps/machine name/dl-machine. That's where the definition is for the relox, which are fixed up at runtime. And I'll take us to the end, where there are some web pages. There is a prose version of this presentation at that website, and this presentation is also at the same website. And I was planning on bringing my electric car to show you guys, but there's information on green cars at the bottom there. Let's get rid of gasoline, okay? You saw it yesterday. Excellent. That was the red Honda Insight?
Silver small.
Miata?
I think so.
That's me.
No
to gas.
Cool. Talk to you later.
Excellent. Okay, let's do that. Any questions? Did it make sense?
Yes. Can I have my laser pointer?
Nobody dozed off. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to stand up here for 15 minutes, and we can do one-on-ones. And thank you very much for coming and for your patience. Hi, I'm the guy...